Good evening, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Aging with Grace for Monday, February 16th. I'm your host, Patricia Grace, coming to you live from the Philadelphia suburb of Hatboro, Pennsylvania, as I do every Monday evening at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a wonderful show for you this evening. We will be joined shortly by Frances Shani Parker, the author of Becoming Dead Right, a hospice volunteer in urban nursing homes. But before Frances joins us, I would like to just say that last week's program was greatly received, and our author, Nancy Wesson, received many emails from our listeners. So I'm confident that you're going to find this program tonight equally as compelling, but much more serious than our program that we had last week with Nancy. I hope all of you out there had a wonderful Valentine's Day, and for those of you who were caring for aging parents, I hope you remembered to do something special for them. My dad always bought my mother a heart-shaped box full of chocolates, and since he's been gone, I do the same thing for her every year, and it still evokes the same story she tells of my dad giving her those chocolates. So it's a lot of joy, and I hope all of you out there were able to share in that. For our listening audience, our call-in number is 914-803-4027. And, of course, you can always visit us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/agingwithgrace. So I'd like to introduce Frances Shani Parker, the author of Becoming Dead Right. And she has put together a blueprint on an approach of death and dying. And so I'd like to welcome Frances to the show. Good evening, Frances. How are you this evening?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I read your book last week and thought it just really very compelling, and was touched by the at the end of each chapter. And for our listening audience, I must say that there's a poem, and it's really very very inspirational. So thank you for joining us this evening. And Frances, can you just give us a little bit of information about yourself and how you became a hospice volunteer?
Well, I was a Detroit public school principal, and there were, over a three-year period, there were two men who came into my life. They were not friends of mine, close friends, and they were not close friends of each other. In fact, one of them happened to be in the local community where the school was. And the school was in a low-income housing project area. And this particular
Where in the country was that, Frances?
This was in Detroit, Michigan.
In Detroit, okay.
Detroit, Michigan. That's where I was the school principal. At any rate, okay. This man had HIV/AIDS, and he also had was in the advanced stage because he also had dementia, but he was in total denial about it, and he didn't have much caregiving available. So I decided to help this man, even though I was quite busy because at that time I had more homeless students than any school in the state of Michigan. But he needed some help. So I helped him, and I thought, well, this probably won't happen again in my life after he died. And a few months later, another man who I also didn't know well was in my exercise class. He also was in the parking lot crying, and I approached him, and, of course, he also had HIV/AIDS, and he also needed help. So I was wondering why this was happening to me, because I really have never been – I've always wanted to be a teacher since I was in fifth grade, to be an educator, and so I was surprised that I was, you know, becoming so involved with the medical field. And around this,
right.
Around this same time, I ran into a friend of mine in a grocery store I hadn't seen in a while, and she was a hospice volunteer, and she told me what she was – doing, and I thought about what I had been doing over the past 3 years. So I decided, well, since I had been working with these men, I would just go on and take the classes, and I became certified, and I've been a hospice volunteer for many years.
Well, I think that's fascinating. There's a book out. In fact, my mother gave it to me. It's called God Winks, and it's basically, are you familiar with the book?
No, I'm not. It sounds interesting.
Well, it's basically things happen in your life that present themselves that more or less take you on a different trajectory and a different path. And it sounds as if God certainly winked to you to lead you into your career of hospice volunteering and working with families in a nursing home setting. One of the things that I got out of your book was you draw from your experiences as a school principal in dealing and communicating with individuals. Why don't you tell our audience about that? Because I think that was really neat how you went back and forth and drew from those experiences.
Well, as a school principal in an urban school, and my school was preschool through eighth, so I had children from three to 14, and it was in a high-risk area, as I said. And so I had already made a good foundation in terms of patience and working in a stressful or high-energy environment. I had experience working with diverse populations, and as principal, I naturally saw myself as a problem solver. So when there were problems in the nursing home, it was easy for me to see that I was responsible for finding solutions. I also was used
right.
to monitoring and reinforcing behavior. And, of course, with children around, I was used to people having fantasies. You know how children are always doing funny things, always have fantasies.
Right.
And I used to like participate in them. So when I was working with patients with dementia, it was really not a difficult adjustment. Also, I found many similarities in the nursing homes and in the schools in terms of I could see things that I knew needed improvements because I could see things that needed improvements in schools. So there
right.
were a lot of similarities. And not only just with the patients with dementia, but also I had a lot of experience with intergenerational partnerships, which I really do like
Can you expand on that? Because that's one of those buzzwords that you hear. You know, people will hear when they tune into programs or they read things in the newspaper. You know, intergenerational programs and things like that. What exactly, for our audience, what is an intergenerational program?
So it's a program where children and elderly people, our senior citizens, get together. And to their mutual benefit. When I was a teacher, I often took students to nursing homes, and I think we should have, I do have a chapter in the book called School Nursing Home Partnerships. I really
yes.
think that schools and nursing homes should work closely together. One of the things that the research finds that's helpful for seniors is to be around young children. In fact, they're even making many nursing homes have child care on the premises so that they can actually interact and mentor. And it helps the children, and it also helps the seniors. And I saw this myself, not only with little children, but even older children in college age and high school, because I think we're losing that in our society.
Well, exactly, because certainly when you were younger and growing up and the same for myself, families were very often together. When someone
right.
became elderly, like when your grandparents got older, or someone was widowed, or someone was ill, they came and lived with you. I remember growing up, my grandfather lived with us for when he had become ill. So nowadays that doesn't happen as often, and so children really don't don't have the same connectivity to the elderly like that. So those types of programs, are wonderful.
Right.
And you also in your book you discuss the disparity between not just the educational system in urban areas, but of course in the nursing home industry. And Can you discuss that? Because I think that we have a lot of people in the African American community that listen to our program and participate, and I think that this is a very important issue that that we should discuss.
Well, some research was funded by the Commonwealth Fund, and what it concluded is that in the Midwest. It just so happens that Michigan is in the top five among these states in the Midwest. They found that
mm-hmm.
because of the racial segregation patterns, that black elderly people had a high likelihood of being in a poor quality nursing home, and it's basically due to the segregation patterns. In the urban areas, blacks tend to be concentrated in substandard nursing homes. They have smaller budgets, smaller staff, and poor performance. And this is something that has to be eliminated by changing the segregation patterns. by improving the structure, the pay structure of nursing homes with the Medicaid?
Well, yeah, that was what I was going to say is, you know, it would seem that there would be greater disparity, I mean, anywhere in the country when you're talking about private pay versus
right.
government funded. I think that, I mean, even, you know, even in white areas, in, you know, suburban areas that might be, have a greater population of whites, I think it's people that are in Medicaid funded nursing homes that are predominantly Medicaid funded versus people that are privately paying. You see different levels of services. It's not, you know, it's not pretty, but it is, it's the facts.
Right.
And, you know, do you feel that volunteers, you know, are needed in a greater level in these types of nursing homes because perhaps they don't have someone watching over them? I mean, I know that in your book you talk about the need for caregivers to be present in the nursing home.
Right.
Because of this disparity in care that they receive.
Well, caregivers are needed to be present in nursing homes regardless of where a patient is, because basically in a nursing home, patients need advocates. And when you have someone who's coming to see about you and the staff and everybody, they know that person or persons will be coming, I think it improves your level of care. Because,
right.
And in addition to that, there are staff shortages, so sometimes there's a need with help in feeding patients. You might be the patient that needs the help, and of course, if you're totally reliant on the staff and there's a staff shortage, that may be, you know, harder to arrange. There are wheelchair rides. There are just even loneliness. A large percentage of people in nursing homes are lonely. And,
yes.
And the research shows that this contributes to poor health, and including Alzheimer's disease later in life and poor sleep patterns. It's about the patient. I've heard adult siblings say, you know, my mother has dementia, she won't know I'm not coming, or my father,
right.
Or there'll be five adult siblings and one or two are doing everything, and the other three are saying, I want to remember Daddy the way he was. And these are just, to me, cop-outs, because it's really
about exactly.
It's not about the excuses, and the, you know, and particularly when patients have dementia. Everybody appreciates having somebody to come and see about them, and also encourage caregivers to not only go at the same time, and to also be sure to drop in sometime at night, because a lot
exactly.
of people, you know, go only during the day, and it's a whole different staff at night, and it's good to know both staff.
I always tell people to stop in at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, because if you're going to see if you know all hell's going to break loose, it happens at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. That was always my experience working in the assisted living industry. That you know, if things were going to happen, it was, you know, on a Sunday morning, because people had called out or things were, you know, the dining room wasn't working, and so you know, people tend to visit, as you say, you know, during the day, or they come on a Saturday at 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock, and everything is working fine, or it's well staffed. But in the evening, or you know, on a Sunday morning, it's not quite the same. And you're right. You know, someone could have severe dementia, but that doesn't mean that you know, holding their hand or stroking their hair isn't a comfort to them. They might not be able to communicate, but it's still a comfort to them, and often you can see it in their face. And so, you know, it's true. People need to have someone there, even if it's just sitting with them and not even speaking, but just being in the same room with them.
Right. And my own experience with patients with dementia is that you really don't know where their minds are. They may be more in tune than we even may know. Because sometimes, depending on degree, sometimes they come in and out. And, you know, I had a patient for a whole year, didn't speak to me, and then one day just started talking, you know, having a conversation. So you really don't know where a person's mind is.
Exactly. I remember having a situation like that, working in a dementia care community, and having a woman who was very, very confused and had very little communication ability, and I saw her, you know, very frequently, and I always addressed her, and she always just kind of looked at me, and one day I was, going through the same drill. And out of the clear blue sky, she was walking down the hall, and she said, "You look very pretty in red."
Right.
And I know how you feel. It was like, this is a lady that I saw for 2 years. She never, ever responded to me. And this one day she said, "You look very nice and you look pretty in red." And that was all she said. And
right.
So it was interesting. I do have some folks here in the chat room. We have a Mary Mandel, who checks in with us on a pretty regular basis, wants to know if she wanted to become a volunteer, how does she go about doing that? You had mentioned about being certified or getting going through some training. Where would you go to do that? Is there a?
I would suggest that she contact a hospice volunteer that's within her area, and
okay,
because all of them have a hospice volunteer coordinator, and she can
okay
coordinator and sit down with that person or talk on the phone and let them know, how she feels about it and just learn more about it. And
okay, great.
All have to get certified.
Oh, okay, fine. I wasn't aware of that. I didn't know that you had to be certified to be a hospice volunteer. I guess that makes sense because it's certainly people need to be prepared for the types of situations that they might find themselves in.
Right. I'd like to just mention, too, all hospice volunteers don't work directly with patients. Some work in the office, some of
mm-hmm
fundraising, and some of them do hospice education. So they have a variety of duties to do if a person may not want to work exactly with a patient directly.
Okay, and all are important, certainly, because we need the fundraising aspect. We need people to man the phones, and we need people to go out and work with the individual. So, all the pieces of the puzzle need to be together to make it work. One of the things that I found really interesting in the book was your chapter on the death journey. Can you speak to that? I thought that was really interesting how families prepare. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I would say to prepare to begin right now before a person is even ill or even terminally ill or ill at all, people can begin preparing. And the first thing they can do is complete their advance directives, which are legal documents that assign someone to manage their medical care when they aren't able.
Mm-hmm.
And also state the wishes that they have for their end-of-life medical treatment. That's really
right.
Important to put that in writing. And also have a will done so it can be determined who gets the property left behind, and maybe make plans for a memorial service, how they want their body disposed of, just as a person would, prepare for any major event in their life. They should prepare for dying, because that's certainly a major event. And basically, if all of those things are in place, then they'll have an easier journey when they're moving in that direction, because everybody will know what they want. What happens is people keep putting it off and they don't do it. Then when the crisis comes, other people are left to try to figure out what you did want. They don't even know, did you want to have your body cremated? Did you want a funeral? Do you want to donate it to science? Do you want to donate your organs? All of these decisions have to be made, and it's better to be involved with that input. Some people even like to complete their own the service, who they want to speak at the service, if they want a reception, what they're going to wear at the funeral. I mean, many people really enjoy making these decisions and not burdening their family with it, and also having things the way they want them. And it makes the
right
journey a lot simpler.
Well, it's interesting. My mother had a gentleman friend of many years. After my dad died, she had a gentleman friend, and when he died, I said to my mother, I said, "Who wrote, Mr. Knight's obituary?" And she said, "He did."
Mm-hmm.
And he had, he knew he had a terminal illness. And so he wrote his own obituary. And I said to my mother, I said, "Well, would you like to do that?" And she said, "Yes, I would." So I was somewhat startled. I never thought about doing that. But it certainly does make, I guess it does make sense, especially for someone who has a terminal illness. I guess it allows you the time to prepare and to accept, with your family what lies ahead. I loved, especially in the book, when you told the story about the patient that was 99 years old, and said that. Well, why don't you tell it? Please share that.
She was. She asked me. I think the one when she asked me when would she be making 100,
and it was. Yes. Yes.
And I said, it'll be another month. And she said, well, I don't know if I want to wait because that's kind of old. It's already 99. But actually, there were three or four people in nursing home, you know, older than 100. So anyway, I told her if she would wait, then I would buy her a balloon that looked like a birthday cake. And So she decided, well, okay, I'll just wait another month. And that way, when I do die, I can tell everybody when I go to the other side that I live to be 100. And so, and she did.
She did. She died the day after her 100th birthday, wasn't it?
It was not too far away from that date.
Not too far. Yes. I thought that was really interesting. And you know, and when you were talking about that, when people are actively dying, being with them and helping them on this journey, that it's
right.
You know, it's really the cycle of life, and it's really leaving one, you know, one part of our life cycle and going on to another. And you know, I just thought it was fascinating. Thought it was fascinating.
And when people are dying too, I want to mention that it's important that. You know, when people are in the room, they still try to include them in the conversation.
Yes.
They'll tell them who's present. And just because they're lying there doesn't mean that they still can't hear. That's usually the last sense to go, so people should really be careful of what they say.
Exactly. It's interesting because my son, when he was a baby, had spinal meningitis, and he was, you know, like comatose, you know, he was unconscious or whatever. I'm not a nurse, but, you know, that type, he was somewhat unconscious. And,
right.
And he was 2 years old, and I was obviously very upset, and I was, you know, I was crying, and my mother was there with me, and she said, and I said to my mother, what if he dies? And my mother said, don't say that. He can hear you. And so when I was reading your chapter about, you know, when people are not conscious, be careful of what you say because they can hear you. And, of course, that popped right into my mind. So, yes, I agree with you. They certainly can. They can hear you. And you do need to be careful about what you say. And allowing people to, you know, giving them permission to let go and being, you know, not wailing and screaming, I mean, but just having a gentle atmosphere, allowing them to leave, I think is important. And certainly something that you highlighted in the book.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Thank you.
When you talk, you also talk, you know, about the 10 tips for becoming dead right. So, you know, in our remaining minutes, maybe you can just give us some of those tips.
Okay, these are the 10 tips for becoming dead right. Accept death as part of life. And that means start having those death conversations that you've been avoiding, because we do have to talk about it and not let it be the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about.
Right.
Listen to the universe. As you said earlier, when I stopped and listened to the universe about why these people are coming in my life, then I was able to proceed and everything fell right in line, and you know, then I became a hospice volunteer, something I hadn't considered. Expect rainbow smiles. Expect good things to happen in your life. Live a healthy lifestyle. Be informed and proactive. Do your best. Give service to others. Be grateful for blessings. And put death wishes in writing. And have a dignified death journey.
Wow. That's it all is so true and makes such good sense, but somehow we don't seem to. I think that, you know, we're afraid of dying, you know, I mean, for whatever the reason, whether it's religious or cultural or whatever, but, you know, we're I think most of us are afraid of dying, or many of us are afraid of dying. So reading your book, it kind of put it in perspective and made it almost seem that it was all right.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's ever said that to you before, but it also kind of made it seem like it was all right.
Well,
and,
we just have to stop and talk more about it. We would just communicate. You know, and I think shows like the one you're having are really good because it opens up that communication.
Right. Now, one of I just had someone contact us and ask if you had ever heard of a legacy will in your work. Have you heard of a legacy will, and
yes,
is that something that you would suggest that folks get?
I have something like that in the book, and basically it's a will where a person, it's not legal. For example, a person might say, I want you all to continue to have certain traditions, or they may say they just want people to do certain things in terms of how they treat each other. It's not legal. It has nothing to do with medical or legal property. It's just like values that are being transferred from one generation to the next, and the person who's
How important is that in today's world? Very important to be doing. When speaking of values and passing on, one of the things that in the last chapter of your book titled "Baby Boomer Haven," why don't you just talk about the cultural change movement that's taking place? I like the Baby Boomer Haven chapter. I thought that was great. But why don't you tell in a remaining minute, what is that cultural change movement that's happening?
Well, there's a cultural change movement going across the country to change the traditional, stereotypical nursing homes that people know and that are not favored too well. And so what I did was I created, in the last chapter, Baby Boomer Haven. It's an imaginary nursing home, but it's really based on best practices of nursing homes that already exist now. So everything going on there is already, but it's not going on in enough nursing homes, unfortunately. So those are person-centered nursing homes where the needs of both the staff and the patients are being met. And in that chapter, a patient in a wheelchair takes the reader on a tour of the way a nursing home should look like.
Right.
The first thing that takes place is that there's input from everybody. It's always welcome. And there are changes in the schedules, the procedures, the environment, technology, smaller houses, a consistent staff. If people want to come to work, so there are no staff shortages. There's childcare.
Right.
And better monitoring of patients. There are many, many innovations that make it nice and more nature, more animals on the premises, all the things that make a nursing home wonderful that more nursing homes need to have.
Well, I certainly could not agree with you more. And I think that, with advocates like yourself, writing about these things and sharing your own experiences, and hopefully with forums like this to get the word out there that we're going to see those cultural changes in long-term care. You're absolutely right. The emphasis is on, making money and cutting services, and that certainly has to change. We need to honor the elderly and gain from them their experiences and keep that going. That legacy going on. Frances, I cannot believe that the time has come to an end. It's been very nice speaking with you this evening. I urge everyone listening or that will be listening when they visit our archive file to read your book. It was wonderful, and I hope that you will come back and visit with us again in the future. If you're writing any other books, please let us know, and we would love to have you come back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And everyone, again, the book is Becoming Dead Right, and our guest this evening has been Frances Shani Parker. Frances, do you have a website that folks can visit?
Right. The book is, the full title is Becoming Dead Right, A Hospice Volunteer in Urban Nursing Homes. My website is francesshaniparker.com, and I also have a blog called Hospice and Nursing Homes Blog.
Okay. Well, we are going to put that blog on our blog so folks can connect directly to you. And again, thank you so much for being with us this evening. And please keep in touch, and we will we'll have you on our blog, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from folks in our listening audience. Good night. Thank you so much.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Well, folks, another show is coming to a close. I'm sure all of you would agree that this was Frances was a great guest to have this evening. Please join us again next week, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, on Blog Talk Radio's Aging with Grace. Thanks so much. Good night.